Light Pollution News, July 2023, Morse code for the ISS. Wow, do we have a great one for you this month. Recorded on location, wind included, at Cherry Springs State Park. We have Dalen Burt, the maestro behind Astroscape YouTube channel. Oh, and Scott Morgan of the PA Department of Conservation and Natural Resources dropped by to share some unique perspectives on how we understand light. This month, we share with you the ultimate summer roadmap for your space-themed Flagstaff trip. Hey, there's a French town where you have the power to turn on streetlights. What does scripture say about light pollution? Corals are in trouble, and much more. Stay tuned for another Light Pollution News starting right now. Welcome to Light Pollution News. I'm your host, Bill McGeaney. Each month, we look at stories and topics ranging from areas such as technology to ecology to astronomy to crime, as they all relate to a very broad, spanning, and impactful topic of light pollution. And even more exciting today is we're recording live at Cherry Springs State Park in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania's only dark sky park, and one of the darkest places in the Mid-Atlantic region of the U.S. This park is a pretty brilliant place, relatively accessible to many metropolitan regions, including Cleveland, Buffalo, Pittsburgh, Philadelphia, and New York City. This month, I'm very excited to have two folks, one who you've heard before and one who you haven't. First off, Mr. Dalen Burt making a return visit of Astroscape. Dalen, how are you doing?
Good. I'm excited for tonight. It's looking pretty good.
Yeah, we've been kind of rained out the past couple of nights.
Yeah, it's been a huge bummer.
It's no secret. I've been trying to learn astrophotography, trying to get on to what you and the gang have over there, trying to get the in and outs and spend copious amounts of my unallocated money to, you know, a giant black hole, so to say. So the past couple of months, I dove into PixInsight. And PixInsight, for those of you not aware, is a spectacular imaging program. However, its user-friendliness is really on par with like a Windows command prompt. It's really a very difficult program to get the curve on. But if you sit down with it, you know, you make progress. And like any good beginner, I scoured the YouTubes trying to find all the information I could. And what do I know? I come across Astroscape. Dalen, you made a great tutorial on how to use PixInsight, especially for beginners. Cuts out the crap, has just enough details I need. I got moving real fast with that tutorial. I got to thank you a lot for putting that together.
Hey, you're welcome. I'm glad I could help. You know, PixInsight, it can go very deep. And let's be honest here, there are people on YouTube that go deeper than I do. But it's easier for me to, because of my usual profession, I can convert like the tech to the easy for the beginner, the one that, you know, hasn't used it before. And I thought doing that with PixInsight, like that tutorial, was a good place to start.
When I was looking for different workflows, I had a buddy of mine, we sat down, we went through some of the processes, and you know, you forget, you have to do it a couple times to really figure it out. But then going back to yours, the way it was noted out, the kind of the flow, and the fact that I didn't have to worry about getting too deep in some areas I don't need to know about, not yet at least, you know, and I thought that was great. So it got me going, able to start editing photos real fast, relatively fast, like, you know, maybe it took a weekend.
Right. Well, these tutorials are great too, but don't be afraid to mess around.
On the other side, someone with a impeccable perspective on the amazing state parks and forests we have here up in the northern tier of Pennsylvania, Mr. Scott Morgan of the PA Department of Conservation and Natural Resources. Scott, I don't know. Can you ask this? How many acres of state forests surround these parks? That's a little, you know, a trivia question. I was just curious to answer to.
You know, the PA Wild Tier is a very large region, and specifically here in Potter County, north central Pennsylvania, which is home to Cherry Springs. We have a very large state forest, but we're also surrounded by four other state forests. So this makes one large contiguous piece of public land. And people will be surprised that between the five forests, we have 1.1 million acres.
Wow.
That includes not only just our forests, but state game lands, state parks, other county and town parks as well. So,
and then a lot of elk that are now moving into town.
Well, I want to say we had a couple elk last year, two bulls that were kind of looking for some mates, but they didn't find any up here at Cherry Springs, Calgary. So they headed back down south, back to where they're from. So,
all right. Back to Benazet.
Yeah, back to Benazet.
Well, I got to say, we love this area. I visited many times in the wilds. We spent plenty of dollars of Airbnbs up here, which have gotten pretty pricey, I got to say. Mm-hmm. Backpack Black Forest, Quijana Trail. Mm-hmm. The wilds, for those of you at home who don't really know about Pennsylvania wilds, they're not really wild, But they're really, as Scott mentioned, a string of state publicly owned lands that cross over into different counties. And, you know, as I remember reading a state forest pamphlet one time that said this area is considered the world famous snow belt. Is it world famous?
I won't. You know, when I was younger, I'm from this area. I would say probably in the early 80s, so that was probably true. But now, I mean, the last few years, I haven't seen the lake effect snows that we typically used to get. I can remember, you know, snows as early October and deep snow, you know.
Oh, man.
Yeah. It was fun being a kid, you know, having all that snow. But this region, I mean, we have, you know, Denton Hill State Park. It was a ski slope that was ran by a concessionaire that was publicly owned by the state as well. We concessioned it out to them. But it hasn't seen the snow as it has before. So, and really the skiing industry has been shrinking over the years. I mean, I learned to ski there. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely across the board all of Pennsylvania. I know, I think northeastern part is the only spot that still has some decent slope stuff.
Yep.
I know down like Blue Mountain, they had to essentially blow snow all winter. There was no snow in the Allentown area.
Yeah.
So it was, yeah, no global warming. No, there's, I don't have to worry about that.
Seven Springs as well in Pennsylvania.
Yeah.
They had to blow a lot of snow.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy. Okay. So why don't we jump right into it? So we have a very interesting show for you today, including some interesting news out of Minnesota. But before we get to that, it's June. And in preparation for summer, astrotourism hit the news hard this past month. We have this article from the Arizona Daily Sun. A day in space. Look no further than Flagstaff for your Cosmos-themed day trip. Start your day off like a true astronomer with a caffeinated trip to Macy's European Coffee House. Next, head over to the Meteor Crater. Then to the Barringer Space Museum. And then to Sunset Crater. Oh, and why not stop at Cindy Lake Crater Fields? And while you're at it, follow that up with an evening over at Lowell Observatory and possibly at the Dark Sky Brewing to close out the night. That sounds like my kind of trip. But not to be outdone, the Matador Network ran this fantastic piece on 11 dark sky Airbnbs in Utah, perfect for stargazing. You can choose from a beautiful convertible A-frame house complete with plenty of windows and a hot tub to, you know, indulge in your star sky experience. Or how about this? A two-bedroom mountain getaway with a roof deck for enjoying the Milky Way. Or what about an earthened home near a Gooseneck State Park in the Rainbow Bridge National Monument? I'm sure if those night skies don't shock and awe you, the cleaning fees on these Airbnbs most certainly will. There's more, though, so just hold on. Have you ever wanted to find a perfect stargazing campsite? Well, you're in luck. HipCamp is unveiling a new dark sky map overlay for campers who are looking for those darkest places to camp. And not to belabor the point, but it really does feel like we're in the middle of a huge astrotourism trend. A new survey finds an increasing number of first-time visitors at Big Bend are now staying outside the park, and they're coming for the starry skies, in addition to everything at Big Ben. It's a boom time. Near 70% of respondents took a survey that they preferred to stay outside Clark, which spiked the short-term rentals, spiked it so fast that the local officials are kind of scared that they can't keep track of the rentals for, you know, tax and regulatory purposes. What's driving a boom? It's clear to a standout point when they take a survey saying stargazing side. So we've been saying this for years now that our starry skies are a hugely important part of Big Bend experience, and we have good data to back that up, per Sarah Allen Colando, a Brewster County commissioner. Big Bend gained the International Dark Sky Reserve designation in 2022 with the hopes of boosting tourism. Folks who appear to be staying outside the park don't appear to be campers, but they still want to experience Big Bend and everything it has to offer all at the same time. We're seeing a lot of that up here, aren't we, Scott?
Absolutely. I mean, astrotourism is a huge drive, you know, during these summer months, especially for the state parks. One of our visitor associations here, the Visitor Bureau between the two counties, its website is visitpottertioga.com. They actually have real-time information on lodging in this area. And a lot of it is catered to stargazing and the astrotourism. I mean, if you look online too with Urbo, you can find any number of camps in this area or rentals that you can rent just down the road here. I mean, you have the Big and Little Dipper camps. You have, I think it's a Starry Night camp. I mean, they're naming their things about the night sky, you know, picking out constellations and whatnot, which is very interesting. You know, attendance, just since I've been here in 2016, attendance at Cherry Springs has almost quadrupled. I mean, 2016, we were looking at 52,000. Last year, we were at 170,000.
Wow.
Insane.
Wow.
Insane, the numbers that we're getting.
Yeah.
And most of those are short-term stargazers, the people that are, you know, coming from those other locations. I mean, our overnight areas, our campground, the astronomy observation field here, you know, we'll see probably between both of them, we're looking at 12,000.
Okay.
For the season.
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah, I know.
Somebody managed 12,000.
The Galaxy Pass sells out like within a month of
it opening,
the last few
years,
right?
Yeah. The last few years it has been selling out. We have 100 Galaxy Passes that we sell for $65 here for the overnight astronomy observation field. It's basically an annual pass for this area. Usually goes on sale maybe a week or two before Christmas. So we know a lot of our patrons like to get them as Christmas gifts. And this year we were sold out, I want to say by February, which is, yeah, a lot of regulars were kind of upset because they didn't jump on the train really quick. But yeah, it's something that we've been seeing in the last three years. So
yeah. Do you have any kind of way to quantify what impact that actually has on the area?
On the area?
Yeah. Well, is that showing, I guess the question I have, does astrotourism actually benefit the area? Or is it, as someone who I will not name, who I had a conversation with yesterday, told me that it's better than nothing. Does astrotourism substantially benefit community, or is it just better than nothing?
Well, I mean, we're an outdoor recreation public service. I'll put it that way, as the Bureau of State Parks. Any type of outdoor recreation, we're going to try and bring into the park. Astrotourism, though, I want to say, when you think about the age of the Bureau, it's a fairly new recreation, but they're definitely seeing it as something to provide for our patrons and visitors. In this area specifically, I mean, you go down to any of the restaurants at Cowdersport, Galeton, and mention Cherry Springs, and you'll hear people say that, hey, you know, that saved us. The astrotourism has saved us. This area in particular was really geared more towards, you know, the hunting, the fishing, the winter sports. It wasn't too much of the summer type recreation. So anyways, the astrotourism in this region has really drove an economic growth. We're seeing, like I said, you know, camps popping up down the road. We're seeing motels and hotels that had closed, you know, in the late 2000s and early 2000s are now reopening and catering towards the astrotourism side, summer recreation. So it's very interesting. I mean, I grew up in this area. You know, I grew up, the population of Potter County was, I want to say, like 17,500, you know, just around that area. I graduated from a school just over a couple hills from here, graduating class of 61. When I came back in 2011, population decreased down to about 15,000, 16,000, graduating classes sitting around 30, 40. So, I mean, just Cherry Springs alone, when you think about the attendance, 170,000 over a 4 or 5 month period.
Yeah.
You know, that's increasing the population of this little county, you know, sometimes maybe 100% in one weekend, you know? So, I mean, it's crazy. It's very interesting.
Since we're on that, Scott, I saw this other article out there from Brian Wipke over at Go Erie. 2 million acres, 8 forests, it's all in the Pennsylvania wilds. I can truly say some of my favorite memories are in this neck of the woods up here in Pennsylvania. Backpacking down a West Rim Trail in the fall, which is an amazing experience in like October, middle October, when everything is orange and you have the sun coming through, and backpacking the sadistic Black Forest Trail in a monsoon where you're crossing the one stream like 85 times. There's the Forest Cathedral over at Cook Forest. I know there's old growth right down the street at Hammersley Wild Area that we visited last time we were up here. And that was another fun trip because you have to ford a stream and cross the stream a few times and stuff. So the Pennsylvania Wilds extend over 12 counties, make some of the most spectacular hunting, stargazing, outdoors of all Pennsylvania. 10 years ago, I would tell people that I'm going to Potter County, and they look at me kind of funny. They wouldn't know what the hell Potter County was. But nowadays, it's kind of a running joke for me. I have friends. We call it the PC Club in Philadelphia because one of them's a hunter. So he comes up here pretty much every November, every December. We have another one that comes up to Lyman or Cinema Honing for the Perseids. And, you know, she's always up here every August and checking out that. I find that folks across the state seem to be aware of Cherry Springs, even if they fumble a word around sometimes and call it something else Springs or something Cherry Tree State Park or something Cherry like Run. That. So, I mean, it definitely sounds like it's picking up. Does Harrisburg have an appreciation for Cherry Springs?
Absolutely. It's very interesting. One of the big issues we have here at Cherry Springs is, like I said, the attendance. It's almost for the staff here, Cherry Springs' popularity is starting to really cause an effect of Cherry Springs and the dark sky. And so the Bureau is actually looking at ways at how we can use other facilities in the Bureau to provide that same stargazing experience. Just this past year, we started a data collection project where we're having our conservation volunteers go around to certain designated sites, but recommended sites. I'll put it that way. We're doing sky quality meter readings. We're also doing horizon photography. And basically, we're creating a baseline for first the quality of the sky, and then second the light domes that are surrounding these areas. And we're going to use that data, you know, to protect it, hopefully reduce the light pollution and whatnot. And then also, as this astrotourism expands and gets larger, you know, spreading it out over. I mean, we're a conservation agency, so we're trying to conserve not only the dark sky, but we're also trying to conserve the land here as well. And when you have hundreds of thousands of people on the property, I mean, it does wear and tear on property. So,
yeah, it's starting to have the issues that some are like Ricketts Glen, mm-hmm. a beautiful location, but they probably have a lot of management problems there because you have so many people, busloads coming from New York City, literally coming in.
Right.
When you're looking into other areas, are you looking at like the National Forest too?
No, unfortunately, I mean, the National Forest we're actually basing our project off of a National Parks project, a data collection. They've been doing it for, I want to say, at least a decade or more. So, right. I mean, yeah, we're behind the times here, but we're doing what we can to catch up. I mean, the Bureau, one of the Bureau's things is we want to provide a great experience for our visitors. So that's just, you know, one of those ways that we can collect data, we can detect, conserve the dark sky. So,
right. The reason I bring that up is because the Allegheny Forest, the Allegheny National Forest here in Pennsylvania, like you go over to Kinzu Dam area and you can camp along the water there and it's almost as dark, not quite as dark as it is here, but almost.
Yeah. But yeah, you're right. And to the casual stargazer who's really just learning about the dark sky, you know, the sky quality of, you know, let's say the upper 20s, you know, 20.7 is good enough for them. I mean, that's we're talking probably Bortle 4-5 area. So, yeah, I mean, for them, that's great. I mean, you're real serious guys and astrophotographers are putting the really dark skies here. But, I mean, if you're a casual stargazer, you don't have to drive all the way to Cherry Springs. You know, you can go to Cinema Honing, you can go to Kettle Creek, you can go to other state parks, you know, talk with the management, talk with the staff. Let them know what you're doing, you know, make a request, and more than likely they're gonna allow you to do that just as long as you're communicating what your intent is. So
yeah. For Moraine State Park over on the western half of Pennsylvania, there's been a couple times where I called ahead and said, let the rangers know, like, hey, I want to get some pictures. You know, is it cool? And I'm gonna be in this area of the park, and
they're
totally fine with it as long as you let them know.
Yep. If you're a hiker, you're a backpacker, you talked about the Quijana, you talked about the Hammersley. I mean, there's a great plateau up there, the Twin Sisters. You know, that was an old wildfire. So it has limited trees. So you got open sky on a horizon, mm-hmm. just like Cherry Springs. But, you know, they don't have the parking lot and the hiking pass. I mean, you're going to have to hike to get there. But if you're an outdoorsy type and you got light equipment, yeah, why not?
Yeah, the outdoors here are spectacular. Actually, it's funny. When I first met Caitlin, she's from Vermont, and she never knew anything of Pennsylvania outside of Philadelphia. So she thought Pennsylvania was all like Philadelphia. The first time I ever took her up to Colton Point, and you can see the Milky Way extend over the gorge. It's a little bit of, you know, the shadow in the gorge. I was like, just wait till tomorrow morning. We came up here a few times, and she fell in love with this area. All right, next article. This one is actually a one-hour video, and it came to us from PBS. Northern Night's Starry Skies begins with Travis Nowitzki of the Grand Portage Reservation connecting the brilliance of the night sky, a feeling I think we've all felt, was something many of us probably have not felt, Native American heritage and spirituality. And at least the people sitting at this table. According to the video, constellations are a way of having the stars connect people between the physical world and the spiritual world. The Dakota Lakota tribes recognize the asterism many of us may call the Big Dipper as the seven star fire nations of the Dakota Lakota people. Dakota people built burial mounds by rivers. This is intended to help the deceased to ascend the river in the sky, or what we traditionally call the Milky Way. The cottonwood tree, complete with its white cotton, is another celestial corollary, acting as a bridge between the earth and the stars. I don't want to ruin this video for you. I highly recommend that you go over to our website, grab the link, and watch the video. And those burial mounds I spoke about, well, they can be used to accurately predict eclipses every 18 to 19 years. Oh, and another spoiler alert, a constellation Pegasus is really a moose. I knew it all along. I mean, honestly, a box that looks like a freaking horse, I'm not buying it. So is lighting up the night sky under the guise of safety and vanity worth the reason to extinguish cultural night sky heritage? When does the balance tip?
I don't think it's worth getting rid of the culture. Watching that video, there's a lot of interesting points made, and just like, aside from astronomy, I like seeing some historical stuff too. And what they went over in the video is pretty intriguing. Like you said, I'm not going to spoil it for people. Go watch it yourself, please. But when it comes to the guise of security, we have the technology now where security doesn't mean the lights have to be on. You know, we can put motion sensors up. We can put dimmers and timers. We don't have to leave everything on. So where the balance tips, I think we've already passed the point where security is the main concern. Now it's implementing the right technology.
And I would agree. I mean, IDA does a great job on educating the public and, you know, the bad effects of light pollution. I mean, and like you said, I mean, with the technology now, there's really no excuse. You know, as I was watching this video and I was thinking about this, you know, I got to thinking about, you know, the cultural significance of it. And we tend to think, when we think of the word cultural, we think of, you know, history, you know, and it's, I think about one monikers that we use here is, you know, that 80% of the United States population doesn't see the Milky Way, you know, because where they grow up. If you think about, you know, someone who was born in New York City and lived there their entire life, I mean, they had a light source 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. That's their culture. So it kind of bleeds out now into other cultures. And I don't want to make it sound like they're forcing that. That's what they know. And it's very interesting. That's where it's our job to educate the public and say, hey, you know, dark isn't bad. It's actually set can be very good. And if you take the time to research it, look into it, look at all those studies that suggest that, you know, crime doesn't increase with lack of light. Some studies even indicate that it reduces. You know, so yeah, I mean,
I think that's an excellent point you make on the culture expanding out, the culture of light expanding out. It really, that I never thought about it like that. That makes plenty of sense when you see someone, you know, I don't know if people come out here, you know, in the suburbs usually, Dylan, you probably tested this out. Pittsburgh, you go driving around and you'll see people who leave the city and they bring their federal maximum security prison yard with them. And they light it up just in case a squirrel decides to steal something off of the back deck, right?
Yeah.
See that camping just in campgrounds.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Even across the road here. It's happened before in times I've camped across the road.
Yeah. We actually have an article up on kind of campground lighting. And I don't want to just point the finger at RVs all the time, but more often than not, it is RVs. And we go out to Raystown, which is a nice big reservoir here in Pennsylvania, and it's got great mountain biking and stuff like that. And when we go there, you know, you're kind of forced to be with the RVs, and it looks, people light up their RV area. And we have actually a great article on there that Caitlin wrote this month. If you go out to Light Pollution News, showing pictures that we took of our last experience at Race House. Quite amazing how many really bright, bad lights are everywhere. And I, God forbid, if anyone's tent camping by these guys, because you're not going to get an hour's worth of sleep. Might as well bring, like, you know, blackout, I call them eyebrows. I don't know what the technical term is for them.
Don't use cucumbers here. You might get visited by a bear.
All right, moving on. Staying in the spiritual connection, we have an interesting piece from Concurrently, a news coach podcast from World Radio and God's World News, an evangelical Christian network, Light Pollution and Creation Care. I don't know about you guys, but I found Kelsey Reed and Jonathan Bowes did a wonderful job objectively explaining the topic of light pollution, namely in regards to how Christians should view and understand the situation. In this podcast, the hosts utilize what they call the SOAR method, survey, observing, analysis, and response, to deconstruct the issue of light pollution from a Christian standpoint. One of the biggest takeaways I found came down to how one should respond, namely, love of thy neighbor and love of the world, suggesting personal responsibility for installing lighting fixtures that spread light trespass into your neighbor's property. There are a lot of takeaways in this episode, but the main theme appears to be an ecological and spiritual connection to the world that God created.
Yeah, I'm not these days religious, but I was brought up religious as a kid, and a lot of the stuff that I saw was about conservation of a lot of daytime stuff. Well, in this article, you know, why can't it also include the night? Protect everything that God created. And I like, too, how they're actually going with the SOAR method, where it is a scientific approach to it. Like, you know, where are the problems? What is causing the problem? Instead of just...
Yeah, they deconstruct it in an organized method. And they have a methodology. And they're using, you know, the Bible as kind of like their prism. And I think the great thing about this piece is that, you know, it showed you that all of our activities, all of our actions have externalities, and just have to be cognizant of what your impact is. Kind of like the same to me. That's kind of like it should be every religion's mantra, but like the Christian mantra on that is that, you know, you should be cognizant of how you are affecting other people. So I found that pretty interesting. I don't know if you guys have any other thoughts on that one. If not, we can just...
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I'm a Christian. Proud to say it. I go to church every Sunday. And I mean, in the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth. I mean, what did he create first? He created the heavens. And, you know, Genesis chapter 1, verse 26 talks about how he created man in his likeness. And then he also gave us dominion over everything on the earth. And a lot of people fuss about that word dominion. What does that mean? We talk about rule. I mean, what do we have here at Cherry Springs? We have rules and regulations, and we're doing that to protect the resource here. And that's really, I think, you know, one of our things that we should do as Christians is protect what God has given us. And that does include the night sky.
You were talking about the dominion piece. What does that actually mean? And how does that relate to your effect, especially on light trespass in your neighborhood, on how you used the tools and gifts that God gave you and outward to others? And I thought this was a great piece.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so did I.
Okay, moving on to some quick hits. Just keeping in a cultural, religious theme, the New Zealand Maori New Year rises this July. The New Year occurs when the asterism Takari, known in Western societies as Pleiades, rises during the first new moon. And you can learn more about this by the one article, New Zealanders to Celebrate Maori New Year in July. And returning back to Minnesota for a second, according to Dan Craker of NPR, the DNR to rewrite mining rules to prevent noise and light pollution in boundary waters. I got to say, after watching that video, I really, really want to go to the boundary waters. I know I've been talking with Caitlin about for a couple of years now, and I think that just really made us fast-track that trip. But a key takeaway here being that, among other issues at hand, the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources will actually be writing new guidance regarding noise and light pollution mining activities in the area to protect not just the, obviously, they have vital water interests and pure water up there in the boundary waters, but also the ecological and natural area of the footprint of the boundary waters. And hey, did you hear the South Tahoe is beginning to make lights dark sky compliant? Kevin Sheridan of Koloe, the city plans to update 214 light fixtures along US 50 and use 2200 Kelvin LED fixtures. Lastly, for the quick hits this time around, I have stated previously that now is the most innovative time than ever for car headlights, and Audi plans to take this to the next level by installing OLED rear lights, complete with different rear lighting signatures to choose from. So LEDs are not just for my laptop, apparently, and a little more that goes to the article we had a couple months back on the lumens are coming and how lumens are, you're going to find new and creative uses for all of lighting technology everywhere you look. So I do have one question on these articles, guys. The 2200 Kelvin, is that too amber? I hear a lot on the safety side that when cities go to do a lot of these conversions, one of the items that they notch is saying that, hey, you can't make out the identity, the color of the t-shirt, the color of the car with lighting. Now, I don't necessarily think that's true for high pressure sodium, but is 2200 getting us back to that low pressure sodium issue where you actually can't make out the specific characteristics of a perpetrator?
Well, I think we're going back to previous discussion a little bit earlier. We talked about the technology, about being able to dim. We're able to, you know, centralize the light, certain things. I don't want to talk about this South. What was it, that town? South Tahoe.
Sorry, South Tahoe. Yes.
Yeah, South Tahoe. You know, I looked at that article and I was like, 214 streetlights. So I was like, I wonder where this is at. So, you know, looking at the article, lift it up, and that is across 1.8 miles of road with 29 intersections, 218 lights. I mean, that's, you do the math, and you cut it in half because we're talking about one side of the road. That's 107 lights every 80, that's one light every 88 feet. That's insane if you think about it. Every 88 feet, so the length of that, the pavilion that we're sitting behind. I mean, that's a lot of lights.
That is insane. I don't think that 2200 is too low of a number. The one thing that city planners need to remember when they're implementing the new LEDs is that they can be controlled. So if, for example, there's an event, if they put in the right technology again, the right controls, they can brighten it up to a different Kelvin during an event. And then after it's over, put it back down to 2200. But for little one-offs where they're trying to look for a car, cameras are getting better these days too. So Canon last year announced one that is better in low light. This is last year or the year before anyway. Once those make their way into the security space, then maybe the amber lighting won't matter as much because the cameras will be able to pick it up.
Yeah, I'd like to touch on a little bit about, you know, they have the technology where when you're going, when an officer with his lights on is going through an intersection, it will change it green automatically based on the lights on the vehicle. And I mean, you can use that same technology to brighten the light in an area. Again, I mean, we're using the line of sight. You know, we're not just broadcasting it in every direction, wasting it, you know. So agree. I mean, 2000 is not low enough. Serves is not too low, but with the technology that we have, I mean, they can boost it if they need to.
Do you think we can overcome fears that the perception of it being too low? Do you think that perception, people have flashbacks? People have flashbacks of low sodium fixtures because that's what they associate mostly with that color temperature. They have no fathom of this new technology you speak of, Dalen, that can change and is variable. People don't think of lights, especially street lights like that, right? They think of it as on and bright or dim and like useless, right? They don't convey that it's a very on-off type approach to thinking. So how do you bridge that gap? How do you convince someone that, hey, you know what? These aren't the lights of your past. These lights are actually very effective. They're going to do what you want and you can augment the light to make it work. In both the cases you guys are saying, augment the light to make it work for the situation you need.
One thing that's being talked about with Pittsburgh streetlights, we just finally got the approval to start the design part of it. So that means they're going to go around and inventory all the lights and start designing on what needs moved around, what needs removed or added and stuff like that. But one of the talks early on was over time, like put them in full brightness and then over time slowly dim them. Over the course of like 5 years, 10 years, to where people just gradually get comfortable with the dimming of the lights, but keep the controls in place for necessities.
But aren't the lights going to come in really bright? Like, why can't they just be set automatically at the brightness they're at now?
That'll be jarring for people.
It'll be jarring for people to,
In two ways. It'll be jarring too bright for the people that obviously don't want it. And it'll feel, make people that don't want the amber feel comfortable. But if we gradually change it along with them to back to orange and people see, oh, life isn't really changing, it's just the lighting's better, then that's a way to approach it.
We'll see. We'll watch the Pittsburgh example to see what happens.
We'll see what happens.
Well, this is a great time to take a little breather. I'd like to thank my guests today, Dalen Burt of Astroscape and Scott Morgan, the PADCNR. And The Wind has been doing a great job today. As many of you know, everything we've spoken about on the show can be found over at lightpollutionnews.com in the show notes. We actually have a link out there. You can also learn more about the show by going out to Instagram, light.pollution.news. Light Pollution News was already taken somehow. Don't get me started on that one. But anyway, you can find us on LinkedIn and Reddit over at r/lightpollutionnews. Be sure to give us a shout out wherever you're listening from. We're always excited to hear from you. But I gotta say, I'd like to give you one more avenue for listening, checking in with us, and that's over on Spotify. Now, we've been on Spotify since the beginning, but Spotify, the app, is actually great for podcasting, and you can partake in new show surveys and questions. It's pretty cool. I really dig what Spotify is out there doing. Definitely subscribe and sign up to wherever you find your podcast. Spotify happens to get my vote, and I do not get paid by any of these groups or anything on a website. So I just want to make that aware. This is just me saying, hey, I really like what they're doing out there. Getting back to the show, we're up here at Cherry Springs State Park, and it's always amazing being up here in a working forest of Pennsylvania wilds. You know, it's always great. Do you know what I saw on Thursday night that I haven't seen much of since I was a kid, and that was fireflies? Around 10 p.m. over here in the field right by the entranceway, I saw some fireflies out in the field behind the sales tent. Last night, they were really, really good. And first night on Thursday night, it was like maybe a few, maybe some green, some yellow ones. But this leads me into our ecology-related articles. So here's something that affects rural America. A new study shows that urban lighting disrupts rural insects. Luis Honey of Sierra. This is similar to a study we reported a couple months back. In short, very low, even when an astronomer may consider dim levels of light, appear to affect moth dormancy, thereby confusing a dormancy timing to be later in colder, less sustainable times of the year. Fabiani goes on to point out that insects historically appeared in large, conspicuous groups, such as clouds of mosquitoes or midges on a hot summer night. And that simply isn't the case anymore. Insect apocalypse is causing declines in the food web, swallows, flycatchers. Insects also aid plant life by regulating pest nutrients. Moths do a ton of pollinating at night. Very important creatures. Fabiani notes that there are places trying to minimize light's impact on the insect population, namely dark sky communities. One such example comes to us from another article, Sustainable Light, Sustainable Landscapes, Sustainable Places, Dark Skies Projects, where Lisa Baker of the Welsh Business News and News from Wales describes 8 designated landscape areas that are all working jointly to reduce light pollution with the explicit goal to benefit biodiversity. God, this feels like something of your wheelhouse. We see assaults on insects from all angles, from pesticides, from the habitat availability, and now lighting. What's the temperature of the DCNR on light pollution being an actual pollutant?
Well, yeah, I think that goes back to what I discussed earlier about this project and this data collection. Not only that, I mean, we're also talking about increasing our meadows for our pollinators. I mean, lightning brought up the lightning bugs, monarch butterflies. I mean, we're willing to do things that are going to help sustain the natural ecosystem. And we're doing a big push on reducing our mowing. We used to treat our parks like golf courses. And we've learned that, you know, hey, we're probably doing more harm than good with that. So, you know, in regards with light pollution, I mean, that's part of it. So we understand, you know, our nighttime insects. We had talked about, you know, these large groups of insects, you know, the safety in numbers, right? So when you start creating this light pollution and you start taking away their natural ways of doing things, I think it goes into the same thing with some of these people growing up in light. Oh, look how it's changed them as opposed to, you know, historical cultures, you know. So, I mean, we're doing the same thing. I'm going to try and change that as well.
Yeah, the culture, that cultural point that you brought up really makes sense if you look at, like I said, I don't want to say the battle of light, but the translation of light between different groups, be it urban, be it rural, whatnot. And you know, in an urban setting, there's so much of a push, and I always joke, like, people are to domesticate, so much of a push for, I guess, sterilization. Like, the whole, everything needs to be very sterile. The living space needs to be sterile. The outside needs to be kind of conformed to sterility. You know, you have to have a yard where literally you do have to make it treated with artificial substances to encourage it to stay at maybe an inch off the ground, right? So it's a very sterile life. And bringing it back, I know in Valley Forge National Park, they used to be all mowed. And then they started letting it meadow. And it becomes, in August and September, one of the most enchanting and cool places to go now, because they cut trails through it. And you see everything. See all types of bugs, all like snakes. You see all types of cool creatures in there. And it's really a fun time to cut through there. And I really hope you guys are best to get that, to get the meadowing back up here, because it'll be really cool to see.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things about Cherry Springs is, the recreation occurs at night. Okay. So we have to worry about the safety aspect of it. We actually mow 30 acres out of the 85 acres of the park. Okay. We've reduced that a little bit. I don't know if you're familiar with what this area used to look like pre-2016, before I got here, but we had instituted a pollinator field just to the west of the campground, the rustic campground on the other side, out here in front of the pavilion. That used to be all the way mowed down to Route 44. We're letting that meadow out as well. We're spreading milkweed seed. It's vital for the monarch butterfly. I can remember, I think it was about 2017, I was walking from the parking lot down to the campground, and I'd approached an older couple. They were walking from the campground towards me, and we sat and chatted for a little bit. I found out that he was actually a retired forester from Cuyahoga State Forest, coming to Cherry Springs to camp. We started walking back towards the campground, and this was right around when the monarchs were making their way through the area. And as we were walking by the pollinator field, an explosion of monarch butterflies off of that field. It was like a huge wave. It was the most amazing thing I'd ever seen.
Oh, that's really cool.
And I try to repeat it every year. I don't know if it was just by chance that happened, but ever since then, I make it an effort to come up here and try and witness again, because I didn't have my camera. If I would have had my camera, it would have been an awesome picture. So
for the mowing, I mean, it makes sense when you were talking about the safety aspect. For the more traveled areas like this, like right where we're sitting and the astronomy field and the campground, kind of helps keep the ticks and all that stuff down. But the area on the other side of the pavilion where nobody's going, what's the point of mowing, you know? Plus, you're wasting resources by wasting fuel, or if you're using an electric mower, charging the battery up to get them to mow. So, you know, it makes sense.
Scott, I got to relay a story. I got to relay a story to you about one of my favorite experiences in the state park here in Pennsylvania. And this was down at Little Pine. And it was during 2021, right out of COVID, right? And I had my dogs still around. So we had this campsite that was like the only dog-friendly campsite. And it was like essentially just a leftover area by a creek. Everyone else is up there. And I'm just, you know, we're by this creek down there. I think it was probably like old group camping. And the, for whatever reason, you know how some of the bathrooms have these horrible wall packs? It was off. And it didn't come on until about midnight. And you had the Milky Way up top. And then you had like a Milky Way on the ground with all these fireflies. It was surreal. I've never seen anything like that in my life. It was so cool.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Kurt Weinhold, that same pollinator field. Kurt Weinhold is a pretty well-known photographer in the area. And he was able to capture a picture like that over at across Route 44 in that same pollinator field with the monarch butterflies. But yeah, I mean, you could see things. Wasn't the Milky Way, but it was the eastern sky with all the stars. And I mean, it looked like it blended right into the pollinator field. It was amazing. Amazing.
Yeah, it's quite incredible. Let's move on to the research article of the month. Global disruption of coral broadcast spawning associated with artificial light at night from nature communications. I don't think there's an easy way to say that. But hey, it's the 21st century and coral gets no relief. In contrast to a prior study, breakdown in spawning synchrony. It's been found that light pollution, not solely water temperature, appears to trigger early spawning in coral. And the study has found that corals may be spawning 1 to 3 days closer to the full moon in coastal areas with artificial light at night. Essentially, Allen disrupts the timing reproduction, further reducing the probability of fertilization and survival. It's surmised that artificial light at night may confuse coral by mimicking the luminance of the full moon. So to put in other terms, absent of light pollution, corals spawn based on cues from moonlight. With the presence of artificial light at night, there is a disconnect that will throw off the timing, the spawning synchronization between corals, thereby impacting coral reproduction. The study appears to be the first step to better understanding algae's role in coral reproduction. It recognizes that further research is needed to directly parse out the cause and effect of algae, especially as it pertains to spawning timetables, and suggests greater understanding is needed to understand the reproduction and the viability of reproduction under algae. So that's another piece to the puzzle. And it comes, again, light plays an impact for ecology, or so it appears to from a scientific standpoint.
So, yeah, I mean, reading that article, you sit and you think about how nature reacts to its environment. You think about how old man-made lighting is. I mean, man-made lighting, we're talking late 1800s, early 1900s. It started really expanding in the 1920s and 1930s. It's a very young industry when you think about nature and how long it's been doing its thing. So, I mean, lighting has drastic effects on every living organism's natural way of doing things that it has done, you know, evolution-wise. I mean, you start thinking about how they do things, you know, that has to have an effect, and it does.
Yeah, it shows, you know, we're seeing back-to-back studies on how lighting changes behaviors, changes patterns, sometimes in good ways sometimes in beneficial ways for certain species, and sometimes, especially for moths and other insects, in very negative ways. And at the end of the day, when, you know, there's going to be a point where we might see some stresses come out of our massive assault on the night. So let's wrap up some more quick hits here. You got to love this. Very cool news out of Chaffee County, Colorado. Vicky Jenfen of Guitar Player Magazine formed to help generate buzz around the Friends of Browns Canyons work to ascertain a dark sky park certification. Jenfen plans to compile a new album inspired and recorded in national monument, including Browns Canyon. A new housing development in Renington, England has residents fuming. They fear new development, which initially planned to install 5 streetlights, will ruin the rustic character and dark skies of Renington, a village that sits in the northeast of England. Per Sarah Darling in an article, the number of streetlights collectively deny all residents a dark sky for which Northumberland is renowned. However, some regulatory entanglements may see the streetlight installed, much to the chagrin of many of the residents. PhD candidate Emma Loudon wants other astrophysicists to cross-pollinate with the space industry. Loudon presents her case via a blog article in AstroBytes. We all know that the space economy is just warming up. Among her justification, skill and scientific interest alignment seem to be a no-brainer crossover. One thing exoplanet Emma didn't discuss was the impact of satellites on Earth-based astronomy. Loudon gives the impression that astronomers do not natively interface outside of their discipline, which, if true, looks to be the root cause of some of the low Earth orbit business proposals we've been seeing as of late. And following this up and finishing this up here, have you ever heard of a moon bow? This is actually pretty cool. There are only a handful of places in the world where you can see these, those being Victoria Falls, the Sky of Isle, parts of Hawaii, and I bet you would have never guessed freaking Kentucky. Moonbows form much of the same ray as a rainbow, just fainter due to the moonbow's reflective light. Moonbows only occur 3 days around a full moon, and due to this faintness, a camera is necessary in order to actually extract out the full saturation. So there you have it, Dalen. Your next trip, make it a mission to Cumberland Falls State Resort Park in Kentucky.
Yeah. You know, maybe when I go down there to hike some of the state, I'll make a point to stop by.
All right, let's take another breather right here. First off, thank you to those of you at home who help us keep the light shining only where it's needed. As a reminder, for only the price of a large coffee can help us cover things like server costs, production costs, editing costs. And if you're looking for more information on any of our shows, feel free to stop by lightpollutionnews.com. Say hello to Caitlin over at Instagram, light.pollution.news. She really likes it when you do that. Oh, and of course, we have a Reddit, r/lightpollutionnews. And we have a LinkedIn, just search Light Pollution News, where above all, we're looking at you. Yes, you at home to join the conversation. There's no easy or quick answer to light pollution, but it helps when we all have this conversation. It helps us grow the influence and get to a finer meeting place to understand the issue. We're interested in your thoughts, ideas, commentary on any of our shows. You can participate in a poll for each show via Spotify, or you can join us over LinkedIn, where we regularly prompt you on any of the questions regarding the articles today, where we regularly have show conversation prompts. But before we go any further, I want to give a big shout out to my guests, Dalen Burt of Astroscape and Scott Morgan of DCNR. Gentlemen, what's new with you guys? Any new projects? Any new things on your end?
Well, just falling in line with our first topic with astrotourism, any of you going to your first dark sky spot or first star party, check out my last two videos and the one that I'm making now for this. It's all geared towards your first time at a star party. So you definitely want to check those out because there's some great tips in those videos and you will be prepared and have a great time.
That is very much needed. That's a great resource right there. So how do we get a QR code over there by the gate?
I guess I can't speak to that. You'll have to submit your proposal through the state park manager. We'll follow up with it. Yeah, you're probably aware. I wouldn't say most of your audience is aware, but I mean, Cherry Springs is going to be going through some major renovations and upgrades here, which is great. It definitely needs it. Visitor flow has always been an issue here at Cherry Springs, and trying to reduce some of the visitor conflict that we have here. We know that this is a special place. There are some people that are very passionate about their recreation here, and we have some first timers. I mean, this goes great with your video there for Star Party, but also, I mean, a first time visit to Cherry Springs. So, I mean, understanding how it's, you know, the park is set up, you know, we get a lot of people who call the state park and ask questions about and some you can tell have not done any research at all. And it's always good if you're going to go into a dark sky place, whether it be Cherry Springs or anywhere else, do your research, get online, look into it. I mean, we provide maps. We provide a lot of text about Cherry Springs as well. But going back to the project, I mean, yeah, so that's going to hopefully reduce some of the issues we do have here at Cherry Springs. It's going to definitely reduce that visitor conflict that we have. So, yes, it's light pollution. I mean, people come and go at night with their vehicles. We got the headlights.
With the ultra bright LED headlights that can light up the tree. Like, I don't know how far that field, the end of the field is, but can see the leaves shimmering perfectly.
Yeah. So we're trying to, redirect traffic so we reduce that and really protect this area of Cherry Springs.
And you mentioned doing the research. As somebody who puts out videos for people doing the research, I can't stress it enough. And when it comes to going to the dark sky spots, I mean, this is very different than Death Valley. So you definitely want to make sure that you do research the area too, so you know what you're getting into.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, and it's easy to pass by up here. Like, it's easy to not really have a good sense of the size of the space, right? When you talk to it, you crack me up, Scott, when you're talking about, like, clearly no one's done the research. I'm part owner of a brewery, and one of the things that we were building was a venue in space. And then we switched over to some other facilities. And one of the things that you learn real fast is that people do not do research. That's not a question of if they do research. They do not do research. So hopefully maybe you guys can get like a little ChatGPT, like an AI bot out there that they can just talk to instead of talking to you guys.
It's funny, being down. So if you're not familiar with the state parks in this area, I actually manage 4 state parks in Potter County. We have one administrative office that administrates these 4 parks here. We have 2 telephones. And I mean, we sometimes can have, I say 2 telephones that the public has access to, but I can pull a line in from my office, my EES, my educator can pull a line in. So we could have like 4 people talking on the phone about Cherry Springs and still getting voicemails. It's crazy sometimes. So
well, I'm trying to help on my front. So that way, the questions are answered in video form.
Right. All right. How about we wrap this guy off, right? We're in the final piece of the show here, folks. Thank you for staying this long. Let's go through our favorite part, and we're going to look at some technology, and then we're going to look at, well, our usual policy segment. But technology here is really cool. So moving on to this next article comes to us from Martin Greenacre of the Connexion. French towns introduce smart streetlights, which locals can turn on. Now, this is really interesting. In France, energy conservation has led municipalities to turn off streetlights at night. Many folks express feelings around insecurity when the constant burning of the streetlight is dimmed. So to remedy the feeling of safety and the town's need to save money, Olivier Bozzetto devised a compromise allowing individual users to activate streetlights for 15 minutes at a time based on their GPS location. All the user needs to do is go to a website and switch on several lights at a time. Is this a path that should be emulated? Do either of you guys foresee any problems with this? Is this a good thing? I'm curious. I'm curious to have any feedback. What about this?
I can definitely see cases where it could be abused. People just leave the lights on constantly. But for the most part, I think after people get comfortable with it, they will just only turn it on when they need it. The one that they're already, it's kind of implemented in general, is the EMS stuff that I was talking about earlier, where if there's something happening, then dispatchers can deal with the lights as EMS rolls up. So I don't know, given the control to the neighborhood, we'd have to see how it goes in this one first.
Well, it's for 15 minutes, right? You'd have to sit there, either create a bot that can do it for you.
That's what I was thinking. Somebody is going to create that app that, you know, automatically does it. And hopefully, you know, this isn't like Windows-based, you know, because, I mean, we're going to have all kinds of hackers trying to hack this. Yeah.
So, yeah, I can see, and I can also see someone sitting in their room, like somewhere in like San Francisco or something, just hitting a button.
Somebody doing Morse code for the International Space Station.
That, or if you grew up in the time of when you get home, you come home when the streetlights come on, somebody turns it on early to get them home fast.
It is an interesting approach, right? I think that's, to your point, when you guys are talking about having a more responsive lighting system, that's kind of getting us there. It's a very amateur approach, but it's, you know, it's filling a need. It's kind of blending both sides.
With everything related to the technology behind the lighting, I mean, this is one step in the research. So I see it as a good move, but like I said, I see places where there can be problems, but we have to see what the research shows.
I going back to what you had discussed earlier about, you know, dimming it over time, I like that approach, because really what we need to do is retrain our brain, re-educate the masses. You know, they're not going to realize, you know, a difference of 10, 15, you know, Kelvin or illums, let's say that, you know, over time. I mean, you continually do that, they're going to get used to it after a while, I think.
Well, we shall see. Well, this leads us right into a great talk now on Western Washington University is saying goodbye to ugly decorative lighting and hello, practical, ecological friendly lighting. WWU used to have ballooning amber streetlights lighting its walkways, no more. Whereas before, lights shot out aimlessly, the new top-down LED fixtures angle and aim the light directly where it's needed on the roadways and the paths. The lights will use a warmer temperatures, which I was unable to ascertain what the actual temperature number was, but this stated to have warmer temperatures. The fixtures are listed as being dark sky compliant, and the administration appears to be valuing lighting changeover for obviously long-term costs, but also on how it impacts the night sky and ecology. This story leads us to the next one, but before we go to that, let's review what's actually happening here. Western Washington University recognized it was time to convert to LEDs. Instead of doing what many communities did, and that was to enter into a first and brightest contract, they saw an opportunity to reimagine lighting that was both sustainable and suited to perceived needs of the student body. I say perceived because oftentimes the issue of light streetlights creates a polarized debate where the middle is taken hostage and you have people who want to maximize streetlights and then people who are going to fight to the death to not have them there. So before I open this one up to you guys, I want to roll this into our Afraid of a Dark piece right here. A piece from Waroni, the student news source discussing the goings-ons of Australian National University. The light at the end of the tunnel doesn't work. Investigating ANU's street lighting. This piece, written by a student at the Australian National University, illustrates what happens when we let our fear run wild. basing everything on 2019 University of Chicago Crime Lab study. You know the one, reducing crime through environmental design, evidence from a randomized experiment of street lighting in New York City. The solution to all crimes must be light, even daytime ones. Now, clearly the situation at ANU is not working for the students, especially folks arriving home late, say 9, 10, or 11 at night. One student raised a concern after walking down a modestly lit street. I can make out a person's shape from the distance, but I cannot distinguish their features like clothes, face, or even if they're carrying something until I get close to them. One of the routes uses motion sensing lights, which the author feared would lead the students to taking longer routes back, as they evidently did not know that the shaded street utilized motion sensing lights. Thereby, they wouldn't go down the street because it was dark. And then when they went down, the lights would come on, but they didn't know that. Another piece was security was, of course, the main theme, correlating lighting as the sole and unequivocal prevention of crime and fear on campus. One student claimed to never see security patrols in their walk. The school does have a 24/7 escort service to help students and assist students who feel threatened or in jeopardy. Now, this is written by a student, and I'm presuming, and I hope to God she has never experienced anything to the level of what she insinuates regularly happens nightly without light. However, maybe we can take a step back from the ledge here. Even though vocal proponents for more lighting like to shout far and wide, a survey among students at Western Washington University indicated that lighting, while first and foremost on a student's mind, wasn't the unanimous driver of insecurity. Western Washington was able to address student concerns and protect the ecology, night sky, and environment. Would that be a workable solution for ANU? Would that pacify even an excited and fearful student journalist?
Yeah, I think it would. I mean, we have to get to the crux of the issue, I think. And obviously they're having dialogue with these students as well. You know, she had talked about students not using the walkway because they didn't realize that it was automatic lighting, which is funny nowadays. I mean, you know, kids want everything right away and automatic. So, I mean, just a little, here we go again, research on their part, finding out about that. So, and again, safety in numbers. I mean, if you'd have that type of fear, maybe why not walk as a group? You know, there's different ways around that issue.
Dalen, I know you have something to say on this.
Yeah, it's a couple things. So the first question would be, when the students are going through their orientation, why didn't anybody tell them about the lights? You know, I think that would be something pretty prominent, you know, for student safety.
I mean, you could also spin it as a energy saver. As a, you know, I've always thought of motion sensing lights as the perfect answer to everything because it fits all the bills. Like, you have light when you need it. I don't really care necessarily how bright it is unless you're walking the path nonstop and I'm living right next door, right? You know, it's one of those things where it's a responsive to the needs of the community right there tool, right?
Right. Yeah. And like for the quote about, or the, I'm paraphrasing about the not being able to distinguish anybody. Even here, looking around the field, I mean, there are people that I can't tell, you know, if they have a beard or they're wearing glasses because they're too far away. So during the daytime, you know, some people still can't distinguish features. So I don't see that as like a huge valid argument. But then again, for security cameras, like we were talking about earlier, if there's an incident, then the cameras need to be able to pick it up. But their cameras are better than our eyes.
Well, I want to ask you on that. The distinguishing features thing, which I understand for criminal investigation and, you know, when we have to figure out what happened in a situation, an unfortunate situation, I get all that. But we had an article in here a couple months back that the sole idea of safety was based on your ability to actually make out the person's features. To me, that makes no sense. I was attacked at 10 a.m. on a Saturday in a very popular part of Philadelphia. I made out the person's features. That did not make me feel safe when he's coming at me with a baseball bat. I definitely do not understand how you can correlate person's features with safety.
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I mean, a lot of different things go through my mind about what do they say about witnesses? you know, stories change. Sometimes all the facts aren't gathered. I'm curious.
Yeah, the facts change. People's memory changes, right? And I couldn't recall specifically what the actual features that the person were. And someone's like, well, it was like this. And they force you to like identify like a race and stuff. I'm like, I honestly could tell you any of this. And I didn't mean to cut you off there, Scott, but I don't really want to necessarily go down the whole, divisibility of a person. But I do think it's a really flawed idea to say that just because you can see someone, you're safe.
Yeah.
It may make you feel comfortable, I guess. But if they have a gun, you're not going to feel safe if they're walking to you with a gun.
I hate to say this, but I mean, I hope we're not stereotyping as they're walking towards us. You know what I'm getting at here?
That's what I got from this article.
Yes.
And that's the number one piece I got from this article, is that it felt like you're trying to lump in certain types of people.
Yeah.
Right. And I think going down that road is a really bad road. You know, there's no certain type of person that's going to, come out and get you.
Yeah.
It's all kinds of people that do it. It doesn't see, there's no boundaries.
I wonder if like light pollution activists are high on their list.
Yeah, I don't know what it is with the correlation of nighttime equals bad people. It's not always the case. I mean, just the people here, amazing people. Even in going to the city, you go to a concert at night, the people around you are usually amazing because you're all there for the same thing. And if we want to go back to like a daytime activity, the hiking community is amazing. Sure, there are bad apples in each community, but that doesn't automatically assume that they're all bad apples.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the piece real fast on this, because I do think we kind of went, I took us down some crazy roads there, so I want to get us back on a paved street here. Western Washington University was able to implement a program that appears to work for everyone. And again, you seem to have the loudest voices on the sides that kind of scream and make the biggest stink about things that can be solved in the middle. Is Western Washington University's model the way you want to approach this? Or is there a better model to approach some of the concerns? And they're very real concerns. I'm not saying, I don't want to disparage any concerns of safety that students may have. I just wanted to explain my story, which occurred during the daytime real fast. But anyway, and I do think that took us off path. So is there a good path to follow? Is that Western Washington University, or is there a better path?
I think it's a good start.
Yeah.
With the way that they're doing their fixtures, how they're top down, so nothing's shining up, and only pointed where it's needed, and they said that is a great start.
And I would agree. I mean, just following light pollution principles is a start in the right direction. And then the technology to help with the security-mindedness of individuals, that might have that fear. I mean, we were talking about coral, and I was glad you didn't ask me about any of those, my topic on it, because one of my biggest fears is water. I mean, that's why I take showers and not baths. So, I mean, I understand. I mean, I understand, fear. Okay. And being able to control it. So, I mean, any way that if you have a serious discussion and you try and come to a balance that's going to help both ends of the spectrum. Yeah.
Yeah. Fear is very real. As John mentioned last month, fear, some people just have a visceral reaction. They're just terrified at night. And I do fear that this cultural issue that you brought up, where you have people who are light dwellers, I say, they're not really light dwellers, but they like to live in a area that is very lit because that's all they know and they feel comfortable there. And I think in some ways, having a dimmer requires it to be, it's a little more challenging for people to have to deal with adversity, and that adversity would be a little bit of darkness. Mm-hmm. But hey, let's wrap this guy up. So lastly, if you're in search of a natural nighttime experience, you don't have to come to US or go to Australia or UK or any real solo English-speaking country. Check this out. India's first astro reserve in Ladakh honestly looks to be a really cool experience. I saw this on Instagram a while back from one of the IDA people I follow, and the reserve sits in a Chittagong wildlife sanctuary and is kind of on the border in the land between China, Pakistan, and India, that spot. The photos in Milky Way are breathtaking. You have to take a look at this, and I'm very glad to see we're starting to see people be able to preserve some of these experiences. And actually, I'm sure as time goes on, astrotourism is going to really grow there. So I want to thank both of you guys. Thank you, Dalen. Thank you, Scott. Dalen, were you able to tell people where to find you? I don't think you mentioned that earlier.
No, I didn't. I didn't say that. So you can find me primarily on YouTube. So my channel name is AstroEscape. I do have Twitter and Instagram. They're both Astro_Escape as well, but I'm not the best at posting on those. So YouTube would be the primary spot, or you can go to my website, astroescape.com.
All right, Scott, do you have any way for people find you maybe, or do you want people to find you? It's okay if you don't want anyone to find you. I get that.
I'll just be very generic. I mean, if you're interested about Cherry Springs or any of the state parks in Pennsylvania, you know, just Google DCNR, Delta Charlie November Romeo, and then the name of the state park. That'll take you to the website. Plenty of information. They have contact numbers there and emails there. You know, I'd be remiss here. Cherry Springs, we have a friends group, the Dark Sky Fund, as well. If you do have a passion for astronomy, protecting the night sky, you know, look at the Dark Sky Fund.
And what does the Dark Sky Fund do?
The Dark Sky Fund basically is a friends group for Cherry Springs that helps with the infrastructure and protecting the dark sky here at Cherry Springs. But not only that, educating the public on light pollution as well. They've been a few instances that since I've been here, they helped, you know, educate corporations on their lighting philosophies and educate them that to help with reducing light pollution in the area. So, yeah.
Excellent, Scott. Well, thank you all for listening. So just as a reminder, Light Pollution News comes out once a month. And next month, we will be on a little delay, but typically you'll see new episodes hit the feed the first Monday of each month. Learn more about this show by heading over to lightpollutionnews.com. Definitely subscribe to Light Pollution News wherever you listen to your podcast. And bonus, if you're on Spotify, say hi by voting in our monthly poll. You can find us over on Instagram at light.pollution.news, on Reddit at r/lightpollutionnews, and over at LinkedIn. Thank you once more. I'm your host, Bill McGinney. Another LPN is in the can.